back at Ethan, said, "After you." Ethan tucked his hands into his front pocket as he walked past Pam. She was smiling like a maniac, her skin still glazed with sweat from the gym. Outside in the corridor, two large, powerful men stood on either side of the doorframe. They were dressed in plain clothes, but submachine guns dangled on straps from their necks, and they watched Ethan with aggressive eye contact. Pilcher led everyone down the corridor and swiped his keycard at the pair of unmarked doors that accessed the elevator to his residence. He glanced back at his guards. "I think we've got it from here, gentlemen." When they were all in the car, Pilcher said, "Marcus tells me you stole his keycard." Ethan handed it over. "Looks like you had a rough night, honey," Pam said. Ethan glanced down at his hoodie, still damp, streaked with mud, torn in several places. He said, "I was on my way home to clean up when Marcus intercepted me." "I'm glad he did," she smiled. "I like you dirty." When they reached Pilcher's residence, Pam grabbed Ethan's arm and held him back in the car. She put her lips to his ear and whispered, "I happened to see you and Teresa out on your midnight stroll last night. Oh, and don't make that face. I haven't told anyone. Yet. But I just wanted to let you know that I own you now." Pilcher showed Ethan and Pam to a circular glass table on the outskirts of an immaculate kitchen. His personal chef was already working up breakfast, the smell of eggs and bacon and ham wafting over from the large Viking stovetop. Pilcher said, "Good morning, Tim."
"Good morning, sir."
"Would you mind bringing out coffee? You can take our orders, too. There'll be three of us."
"Of course."
The light coming through the window beside the table was gray and dismal. Pilcher said, "I hear it snowed last night." Ethan said, "Just a dusting."
"First snow seems to come earlier every year. It's only August."
A young, clean-shaven man in a chef's coat walked over from the kitchen carrying a tray with three porcelain cups and a large French press. He set everything on the glass and carefully lowered the plunger, filled everyone's cup, said, "I know that Pam and Mr. Pilcher take it black, Sheriff. May I get you some cream and sugar?"
"No thanks," Ethan said.
It smelled like good coffee. It tasted infinitely better than what they served in town, the way Ethan remembered it from Seattle. Pam said, "You would have been so proud of our sheriff yesterday, David."
"Oh yeah? What'd he do?"
"He visited with Wayne Johnson. Your first integration, right, Ethan?"
"Yeah."
"Mr. Johnson was having a difficult time asking the hard questions they all ask. Ethan handled it perfectly."
"Glad to hear that," Pilcher said.
"It was like watching our baby boy take his first steps. Just really beautiful."
Tim took their orders and headed back into the kitchen. Pilcher said, "So we're dying to hear all about your evening, Ethan."
Ethan stared down at the steam rising off the surface of his coffee. He was in a rough spot. If this man were capable of killing his own daughter, what would he do to Ethan and his family if Ethan refused to name names? But if Ethan spilled, he was signing Kate's death warrant. Impossible choices. And if that wasn't enough, Pam knew that he'd removed Teresa's chip.
"Ethan, tell us everything you saw."
Threatened with her life, Alyssa might not have named names, but she had undoubtedly told her father, or Pam, the truth. She would have said that Kate's group wasn't dangerous, weren't planning a revolution, that they only meant to experience moments of freedom, and still she was murdered. The truth hadn't helped Kate and her group. The truth hadn't saved Alyssa.
"Ethan?"
In a moment of horrifying, blinding clarity, he understood what he had to do. Risky. Insane.
"Ethan, for fuck's sake!"
But his only play. He said, "I got in."
What does that mean?
Ethan smiled. I saw the inner circle.
You were taken to where they meet?
They blindfolded me and led me off into the forest. We climbed this cliff to a cavern halfway up the mountain.
Could you find this place on your own?
I think so. I wasn't blindfolded for the return trip.
I'll want you to draw a map.
Sure.
So what did you see?
There were 50 or 60 people there, including your former partner and her husband.
Oh, yes.
And Kate and Harold? They were clearly running the show.
You recognized others.
I did.
We'll need a full list of names.
Shouldn't be a problem. But you should know something.
What?
I went into last night expecting a harmless gathering. Any time there are rules in place, it's human nature for people to sneak around them. The speakeasies of the 1920s are a perfect example. But this gathering, these meetings, they aren't harmless. Pilcher and Pam exchanged a glance, the surprise in their faces unmistakable. Clearly, Alyssa had told them the opposite. Ethan said, "Frankly, I thought you were just being a control freak, but you were right. They're actively recruiting new members, and they have weapons."
"Weapons? What kind?"
"Homemade, mostly. Hatchets, knives, bats. I saw one or two handguns. They're amassing quite the armory."
"What do they want?"
"Look, everyone was very nervous having me around. I can imagine. But from what I gathered, they want to take control. To turn the entire town. That much is clear. They aren't risking their lives to go to these meetings just to sit around and talk about the good old days before Wayward Pines. They know they're under surveillance. They know there's a fence. Some of them have even gone to the other side."
"How?"
"I don't know yet." Ethan wrapped his hands around his coffee mug to let them warm against the heated porcelain. "I'll be honest. I was skeptical going in," Ethan said. "But you... we have a serious problem."
"What about Alyssa?" Pam asked.
"Are you asking if they killed her?"
"Yeah."
"Well, nobody walked up and confessed while I was there, but what do you think?"
"Look, these people are ultra-paranoid about being discovered.
They don't know specifically who you are, David, but they know someone like you exists. They know someone is controlling all of this. And they want to stop you by any means necessary. They want war, liberty or death and all that shit."
Tim returned carrying a silver tray. He set down a plate of fresh fruit, certainly the last of it, from the gardens.
"A poached egg on sourdough for you, Mr. Pilcher, eggs Benedict for you, Pam, and scrambled for you, Sheriff." He freshened up everyone's coffee and left. Pilcher took a bite of his egg, studied Ethan for a moment. He said finally,
"You understand, Ethan, that a war between the last several hundred human beings on the face of the earth is something that cannot be allowed to happen."
"Of course."
"What would you propose?"
"I'm sorry?"
"If you were me, what would you do?"
"I don't know. Haven't really had a chance to consider it."
"Why do I find that hard to believe?"
"Pam?"
"Well now, first things first. I would have our super-duper sheriff here write down the names of each and every person he saw last night at the little soiree. Then I would ask me," she pointed at herself, "to put together a small team. We'd roll through town and in one night disappear every last motherfucker on that list." She smiled. "Then again, I'm on the rag, so maybe I'm just feeling a bit bloody. No pun intended."
"You would put them all back into suspension?" Pilcher asked.
"Or kill them horribly. I mean, at this point, they kind of strike me as lost causes, don't you think?"
"How many did you say there were, Ethan?"
50 or 60.
"I can't see sacrificing so many of my people. Call me a hopeless optimist, but I have to think there's a percentage of Kate's group who could be persuaded by means less final than torture and death."
Pilcher dashed a modest helping of salt across his eggs. took a bite, gazed out the window in the rock. It was a stunning vista through the face of a cliff. 1,000 feet below, a forest swept down the mountainside into town. When Pilcher turned back to the table, he wore a new look of resolve. He said, "Ethan, it's going to be an interesting night ahead for you." "How's that?" "You're going to call your first fate."
"For who?"
"Kate and Harold Ballinger will be the guests of honor." Pam was beaming.
"What a brilliant idea," she said. "Cut off the head of the snake, the rest of it dies."
Pilcher said, "I know the only fate you've experienced, Ethan, was your own, but I assume you've studied the manual, that you know what will be expected of you."
"Any qualms with overseeing the execution of your former fling?" Pam asked.
"Your sensitivity is overwhelming," Ethan said. "Someday remind me to explain to you what empathy is."
"Perhaps it was poorly phrased," Pilcher said, "but the question is apt. Are you up to this, Ethan? And don't misunderstand me and think that I'm implying you have a choice in the matter."
"I dread it," Ethan said, "if that's what you're asking. I loved her once. But after last night, I understand the need for what's going to happen."
The muscles in Pilcher's face seemed to relax.
"To hear you say that, Ethan, nothing would make me happier than for you to be fully on board. The three of us working together, for me to have your complete loyalty and trust. It's so important, and there's so much I haven't told you, so much I want to share. But I have to know you're really with me."
"The Ballingers have to be taken alive," Pam said. "You have to make that clear from the start to the officers, or our guests will be killed in some alley. In light of the message we're trying to send, they need to die in the circle on Main Street. It needs to be bloody and awful so that all the people in their group understand the price of their disobedience."
"I'll be watching how you run this fate," Pilcher said. "Your performance tonight can go a long way toward building some real trust between us."
Pilcher finished off his coffee and stood.
"Go home, get some sleep, Ethan. I'll send Dr. Mitre into town this afternoon to sew your chip back in."
Pam smiled.
"God, I love the fates," she said. "Even better than Christmas. And I have a hunch the townspeople do, too. You know, some of them keep costumes in their closets for the big night. They decorate their knives and rocks. We all need to go a little crazy now and then."
"You consider killing two of our own just going a little crazy?" Ethan asked.
"At the end of the day, it's what we do best, isn't it?"
"I hope that's not true."
Pilcher said, "Personally, I hate the fates. But then again, those are my people down there. And as hard as it is, I know what they need. Perfection all the time would drive them mad. For every perfect little town, there's something ugly underneath. No dream without the nightmare."
Chapter 20. Ethan walked into his dark house. He ran a bath downstairs and went up to his bedroom. Teresa was asleep under a mountain of blankets. He leaned down and whispered in her ear, "Come join me in the bath." The water in the tub was the only hot thing in the house, but it was gloriously hot. The room had filled with steam by the time Teresa wandered down. It coated the mirror over the sink, the window above the tub, made the plaster look as if it was perspiring. She undressed, stepped into the water, and eased down between his legs. With the two of them in the water, there was only an inch between the surface and the lip of the clawfoot tub, the warm mist so thick he could barely see the sink. With his foot, Ethan turned the knob just enough to fill the bathroom with the noise of running water. He pulled Teresa back into his chest. Even in the heat, her skin was cool against his. Her ear was right at his lip, and it was such a perfect position to talk to her that he didn't know why it had never occurred to him before.
steam enveloped them. He said, "Kate's people didn't kill that woman whose murder I was investigating."
"Then who did?"
"Either Pam, someone else under Pilcher's employ, or the man himself."
"His own daughter?"
"I don't know that for sure, but regardless, there's going to be a fate tonight."
"For who?"
"Kate and Harold."
"Jesus. And as sheriff, you have to run it."
"That's right."
"Can't you stop it?"
"I don't want to stop it."
"Ethan."
She turned her head and looked up at him.
"What's going on?"
"Better if you don't know."
"You mean in case you don't pull it off?"
"Yeah."
"How real is that possibility?"
"Very. But we talked about it last night. I promised you I'd fix this, even if it meant we took the risk of losing everything."
"I know, it's just..."
"A little different when the rubber actually meets the road. Pam knows about us, by the way, that we went out last night."
"Has she told anyone?"
"No, and I'm betting that she won't, at least not before the fate."
"But what happens if she says something after?"
"After tonight, none of this will matter anymore. But look, I don't have to do this. We could fall in line, live out the rest of our days as good little townies. I'd be sheriff. There'd be perks to that. We have no mortgage here, no bills, everything provided for. I used to work late every night. Now I'm always home for supper. We have more time together as a family." Teresa whispered, "There's a part of me that wonders if I could buy into it, you know. Just settle. But it wouldn't be a life, Ethan. Not on these terms." She kissed him, her lips gone soft from the steam and the heat.
"So do whatever you have to do. And just know that no matter what happens, I love you. And I've felt closer to you in the last 24 hours than in the last 5 years of our marriage in Seattle."
The snow was gone by mid-afternoon. Under a blue winter sky, Ethan stood just beyond the fence that encircled the school. Children streamed out of the brick building and down the steps. He spotted Ben walking with two friends, backpacks hanging from their shoulders, talking, laughing. How normal it all seemed. Kids getting out of school for the day. Nothing more. Ben reached the sidewalk. He still hadn't noticed his father. Ethan said, "Hey, son." Ben stopped, and so did his friends.
"Dad, what are you doing here?"
"Just felt like picking you up from school today. Mind if I walk you home?" The kid didn't look like he wanted to be walked home by Dad, but he hid the embarrassment with grace. Turning to his friends, he said, "I'll catch up with you guys later this afternoon." Ethan put his hand on Ben's shoulder. He said, "How about we go to your favorite place in the world?" They walked 4 blocks down to Main Street and crossed to a candy store called the Sweet Tooth. Some of the school kids had beaten them there, clusters of boys and girls grazing the hundreds of glass jars filled with gumballs, Spree, Sweet Tarts, Pixie Sticks, Crybaby Bubblegum, Jolly Ranchers, Jawbreakers, M&Ms, Starbursts, Pez, Skittles, Sour Patch Kids, Nerds, Smarties, Atomic Fireballs. No staple of teeth-rotting goodness absent from the collection. Ethan knew that, like everything else, it had all been stored in suspension. But he couldn't help thinking that if anything could last unchanged for 2,000 years, it had to be a jawbreaker. He and Ben ended up at the chocolate counter. Homemade fudge in all its permutations beckoned from beneath the glass. Ethan said, "Pick out whatever you want." Armed with hot chocolates and a paper bag heavy with an assortment of fudge, Ethan and Ben strolled the sidewalk. This was the busiest time of day in Wayward Pines, with school having just let out and the streets wonderfully noisy with the laughter of children. It never felt more real than this. Ethan said, "Let's find a place to sit." He led his boy across the street to the bench on the corner of Main and 9th. They sat drinking their hot chocolates and nibbling at the fudge and watching people walk by. Ethan said, I remember when I was your age. You're a much better kid than I was. Smarter, too.
The boy looked up, fudge crumbs around his mouth.
Really?
Between his glasses and the ear flaps that hung down from his hunting cap, Ethan thought he bore a strong resemblance to Ralphie from A Christmas Story.
Oh, yeah. I was a little shit. Mouthy. Full-on rebellious streak.
This seemed to amuse Ben. He sipped his hot chocolate.
School used to be just school, Ethan said. We had homework, parent-teacher conferences, report cards.
What's a report card?
A slip that showed what your grades were for a quarter. You probably don't really remember when you went to school in Seattle. This one's a little different. Now Ben stared down at the pavement under their feet.
What's wrong, son?
You're not supposed to talk about that.
He said it in a grave, quiet voice.
Ben, look at me.
The boy looked up.
I'm the sheriff of Wayward Pines. I can talk about whatever the hell I want.
You understand I run this town.
The boy shook his head.
No, you don't.
Excuse me?
Now Ben's eyes were filling up with tears.
We can't talk about this, he said.
I'm your father. There's nothing you and I can't talk about.
You aren't my father.
A shiv straight into Ethan's gut would have felt better. He lost his breath, saw the world suddenly through a blur of tears. He barely found his voice.
Ben, what are you talking about?
Not my real one.
I'm not your real father.
You don't understand. You never will. I'm going home.
He started to stand, but Ethan put his arm around him, held him to the bench.
Let go of me.
Who do you think your real father is? Ethan asked.
I'm not supposed to talk about...
Tell me.
The one who protects us.
Protects from what?
The boy glared up at Ethan, all tears and vitriol, said,
The demons passed the fence.
You've been beyond the fence? Ethan asked.
The boy nodded.
Who took you?
Stonewall.
Was it a short, older man with a shaved head and black eyes?
Ben didn't answer, but it was an answer.
Look at me, son, look at me.
What do you mean when you say he's your father?
I told you. He protects us. He provides for us. He created all of this, everything we have in Wayward Pines.
That man is not God, if that's what you've been.
Don't say that!
Ethan thinking, if there were no other reason for burning this place to the ground, it's this. They're stealing our children away from us.
Ben, there are things in this world that are true and that are lies. Are you listening to me? Your mother's and my love for you, there is nothing truer than that.
Do you love me?
Of course I do.
Do you trust me?
Yes.
That man who took you past the fence is not God. He's the furthest thing from it. His name is David Pilcher.
You know him?
I work for him. See him almost every day.
Suddenly, Megan Fisher was standing in front of them. Ethan hadn't even heard her footsteps. She'd come out of nowhere.
Kneeling down carefully in her woolen skirt, she put her hand on Ben's knee.
Everything okay, Benjamin?
Ethan forced a smile.
We're fine, Megan, he said. Rough day at school.
I'm sure you know how that goes. But nothing a little trip to the sweet tooth can't fix.
What happened, Benjamin?
The boy was staring down into his lap, literally crying into his hot chocolate. Ethan said,
It's kind of a private matter.
This snapped Megan's head up. Gone was the perky, pleasant host who had welcomed him and Teresa into her home several nights ago. She said,
Private?
Like she didn't understand the meaning of the word. Like Ben was her son, and it was Ethan overstepping his bounds.
At School of the Pines, she went on, we believe in a community approach to,
yeah, private. Like mind your own fucking business private, Mrs. Fisher.
The look on her face, pure shock and disgust, made Ethan fairly confident she had never been spoken to like that before. Certainly not since she'd woken up in Wayward Pines and attained this position of power. Megan stood straight up and scowled down at him like only a teacher can. She said,
"They're our children, Mr. Burke."
He said, "Like hell." As she stormed off down the sidewalk, Ben launched out of his father's grasp and sprinted away across the street.
"Afternoon, Belinda," Ethan said as he walked into the sheriff's office.
"Afternoon, Sheriff."
She didn't look up from her cards. "Any calls?"
"No, sir."
"Anyone been by?"
"No, sir."
He rapped his knuckles on her desk as he walked past, said, "Hope you're in the mood for some big fun tonight." He could feel her eyes on him as he moved on down the hallway toward his office, but he didn't look back. Inside, he hung his hat on the coat rack, went to the closet, unlocked the door. He'd only opened it once before, his avoidance purely psychological. The things inside represented what he hated most about his job, this town, what he'd been dreading since day one. His predecessor's costume hung from a brass wall hook. During his own fate, he'd only glimpsed Sheriff Pope from afar, the details of this outfit lost in the midst of Ethan's fear and panic. Up close, it looked like the cloak of a demon king. Fashioned out of a brown bear's coat, there was extra fur padding under the shoulders, and it tied across the collarbone with a link of heavy gauge chain. The fur itself clumped in places where Ethan suspected blood had spattered, stuck, dried. But no effort had been made to clean the garment, which reeked like the breath of a scavenger, rotted blood and decay. But none of it rivaled the adornments. The scalp of every prior guest of honor had been stitched into the fur. 37 in all. The earliest resembled beef jerky. The most recent were still pale. On a shelf above the cloak rested the headdress. The skull of an abbey formed the centerpiece. The jaws were wide open, held in place with metal rods, and a rack of antlers had been screwed down into the top of the brain box. A sword and a shotgun lay across brackets in the wall. The rhinestones that covered them glittered under the overhanging light bulb. Ethan startled when his telephone rang. Such a rare occurrence. He walked out into his office, around his desk, and caught it on the fifth ring. Answered,
"Sheriff Burke speaking. Do you know who this is?"
Even though he spoke at barely a whisper, Ethan recognized the voice as Ted's. He said,
"Yes.
How'd you know I was here?"
"How do you think?"
Of course. Ted was watching him from surveillance inside the mountain.
"Is it safe for us to talk like this?" Ethan asked. "Not for long."
"They'll find out?"
"Eventually. Question is, will it matter when they do?"
"What does that mean exactly?"
"I found it."
"Found what?"
"That thing we were looking for? It was buried, hidden deep, but nothing can truly be erased."
"And?"
"Not over the phone. Can you meet me in the morgue in 20 minutes?
"Sure."
"Dr. Miter just walked into your station. You better get going."
Ethan heard voices in the background, the sudden shuffle of Ted hanging up his phone. The moment Ethan shelved his phone, it rang again.
"Hi, Belinda," he said. "Sheriff, there's a Dr. Miter here to see you."
"To reinsert my microchip." "I'm kind of in the middle of something. Would you mind getting him a cup of coffee and showing him over to the waiting area?"
"Yes, sir."
Ethan opened the deep left-hand drawer of the desk, lifted out his leather belt and holster, strapped it on. He turned his attention to the gun cabinets, unlocked the doors and the drawer on the middle one. From the drawer he lifted out a Desert Eagle, popped in the magazine, holstered it. Then he took down the Model 389 rifle, a camo stock with a blued assembly and 4x32 scope. His phone rang again. He grabbed it.
"Yes, Belinda?" Dr. Mitre doesn't really want to wait anymore.
A doctor who doesn't want to wait? Do you see the irony there, Belinda?
I'm sorry, sir.
I'll be right out. Ethan hung up the phone and moved to the window beside the gun cabinet. It was a slider. He opened the clasps, forced it open, then pushed the screen completely out of the frame. Climbing awkwardly over the sill, he lowered himself behind the row of bushes that lined the front of the building, fought his way through the grabby branches, and jogged down toward the street. He'd driven the Bronco to work this morning, and he pulled open the driver's side door and stowed the rifle on the gun rack. As he cranked the engine, he could hear the phone in his office ringing again through the open window. Ethan pulled his Bronco into an empty parking space on Main and walked over to the storefront glass of Wooden Treasures. Kate was sitting behind the cash register, staring with a kind of bored, blank intensity into nothing. To go from that brilliant sliver of freedom last night back to the day-to-day enslavement that defined life in Wayward Pines must be a crushing thing, he thought. Figured the days after their secret parties were filled with hangovers and the hard edge of reality, of what their lives truly were. Ethan knocked on the glass. They sat on the bench on the corner of Main and Ninth. The downtown had emptied out. It didn't look real anymore. Could have been the set of a movie after production had stopped. Already the light was beginning to fail as the sun slipped behind the western wall of rock.
"We're safe to talk here," Ethan said.
"You look terrible," Kate said. "Have you slept?"
"No."
"What's wrong?"
"I need to know how to find the tunnel under the fence."
"Why?"
"There isn't time to explain. Have you been to it?"
"Once," she said. "Years ago."
"Did you go through to the other side?"
She shook her head.
"Why?"
"Scared."
"How do I find it, Kate?"
"There's a big dead pine stump, as tall as you, bigger around than anything near it. If it's still standing, you can't miss it. The door to the tunnel is right beside it, in the forest floor. It'll be covered over with pine needles. I don't think anyone's gone to the other side in a long, long time."
"Is it locked?"
"I don't know. Ethan, what's going on?"
He stared at her, wanting to tell her, wanting to warn her. He said, "You're just going to have to trust me." Ethan parked his Bronco out of sight in the alley behind the hospital, slipped in through a service door. The ground floor stood absolutely silent. He took the stairs down to the basement and stepped out into the intersection of four vacant corridors, headed toward the windowless double doors at the terminus of the east wing. The last few fluorescent light panels near the morgue had gone out. He reached the doors in semi-darkness, pushed through. Ted stood at the autopsy table at an open laptop. Ethan walked over as the doors swung closed behind him, said quietly,
"We safe to talk here?"
"I killed the surveillance cams to the hospital sublevel." He glanced at his watch. "But they'll only stay in sleep mode another 10 minutes.
"Where's Pam?"
"Upstairs in a therapy session."
Ethan moved around the gleaming table, stood beside Ted. He glanced at the cold chambers, the sink, the organ scale. Ted had angled the examination lamp away from the table, so it fired one corner with an obscene radiance and left the rest of the morgue to shadows. The laptop finished powering up. Ted typed in his username and password.
"Why here?" Ethan asked.
"I'm sorry?"
"Why did you want to meet here?"
Ted pointed at the screen. The footage rolled. HD quality. From a corner in the ceiling, a camera aimed down at Alyssa. Ethan said, "Fuck." Strapped with thick leather restraints to an autopsy table. To this autopsy table.
"No audio?" Ethan asked.
"Didn't have the time to find it. Trust me, you'll be glad of that."
Alyssa was screaming something, her head lifting off the table, every muscle straining. Pam appeared. She took a handful of Alyssa's hair and jerked her head down hard against the metal table.
David Pilcher moved into the frame. He set a small knife on the metal and climbed up onto the table, sat astride his daughter's legs. He lifted the knife. His lips moved. Alyssa screamed something back as Pam held her head in place. Pilcher's lips pursed. His head cocked to one side. He didn't look angry, wore no expression at all as he stabbed his daughter in the stomach. Ethan recoiled. Pilcher pulled out the blade as Alyssa writhed against the restraints. Black blood began to pool on the autopsy table. Pilcher's lips moved again as Alyssa's face disintegrated into agony, and when he raised the knife for another strike, Ethan turned away. He felt sick, swallowed against the taste of iron in the back of his throat. "I think I get the idea." Ted leaned down and typed on the laptop. The screen went mercifully black. "And it goes on like that," Ted said. "On and on and on." Ethan felt shaken for having seen it. Thought of all those black holes in Alyssa's body he'd seen that first day in the morgue. He said, "So that night, after Alyssa and Kate parted ways, Pam followed Alyssa, somehow got her down here in the basement. Maybe Pilcher was already waiting for them. Maybe he came after. When I inspected her body several days ago in this morgue, I wondered how and why she had been drained of blood. Where she had been killed.
And you were standing at the scene of the crime."
Ethan stared down at the drain beneath his boots. "You have a copy of this footage, Ted?"
"I made several."
Ted reached into his pocket and took out a fingernail-sized memory card.
"This one's for you. It won't play on any device in town, but in case something happens to me and the only other copies of this footage, keep it in a safe place."
Ethan slid the shard into his pocket. Ted looked at his watch.
"A few more minutes and we better be gone. What now? I considered just airing this footage on every screen in the mountain."
"No, don't do that. Go back to work. Carry on like nothing has changed."
"I'm hearing there's going to be a fate tonight for the Ballingers. Word's already spreading in the mountain they're responsible for Alyssa's death. What are you going to do?"
"I have something in mind, but I haven't told anyone."
"So just stand by?"
"Yeah."
"Okay."
Ted took one last glance at his watch.
"We better get moving. The cameras wake up in 60 seconds.
It was 4 PM when Ethan reached the curve in the road at the end of town. He kicked the Bronco into four-wheel low, drove down the embankment and into the forest. The ground was soft and patches of snow lingered in the shade between the pines. It was slow going. A half mile seemed to take forever. He spotted the first pylon through the windshield, and as he approached, the cables materialized, and then the coils of razor wire along the top. He stopped the Bronco 30 yards back. Dark enough to warrant headlights, but he didn't want to risk turning them on. Sitting behind the wheel as the engine idled, he couldn't escape what a fear-inspiring thing it was to behold. Just some steel and current. And considering all that it was expected to keep out of wayward pines and what it was intended to keep safe, it seemed so fragile. Hardly like all that was standing between humanity and extinction. Kate had been right. The stump was unmissable. From a distance, it looked like a great silver bear, standing on its hind legs, the dead, gnarled branches near the top raised high like threatening claws, the kind of ominous shape which, at dusk, might give someone a start. Ethan parked beside it. He grabbed the rifle. Stepped down onto the forest floor. It was getting dark too fast. The door slam echoed through the woods. Then silence rushed in. He circled the stump. There was no snow here, just a bed of compressed pine needles and nothing that would indicate a door. He opened the back window of the Bronco and lowered the tailgate, grabbed the shovel and the backpack. A half hour into digging, the head of the shovel struck something hard. Throwing it aside, he fell to his knees, used his hands to tear out the rest of the pine needles, two, maybe 3 years' worth of accumulation. The door was made of steel, 3 feet wide, 4 feet tall, flush against the ground. The handle was locked down to an eye bolt with a padlock, which years of rain and snow had rusted into oblivion. One hard blow from the shovel broke off the lock. He shouldered the backpack, loaded the rifle, slung it over his right arm. He drew the big pistol and jacked a 50-caliber hollow-point cartridge into the chamber. The hinges on the door creaked like fingernails down a blackboard, pitch black inside. The damp earth smelled of crawl space. Ethan tugged the maglite off his belt, clicked it on, paired it with the Desert Eagle. Steps had been cut into the earth. Ethan carefully descended. After 9, he had reached the bottom. The beam of light showed a passageway framed up and supported by 4x4s. The construction looked makeshift and hurried, confidence not inspired. Ethan walked under the tree roots and rocks lodged in the dirt. The walls seemed to narrow in the middle, his shoulders brushing against them, and he had to move like a hunchback so his head didn't scrape the ceiling. Midway through, he thought he heard the fence humming through the ground, thought he felt a tingling in the roots of his hair from his proximity to that astronomical voltage straight above his head. There was a tightness in his chest, like his lungs were constricting, but he knew that was a purely psychosomatic response to moving through this subterranean space. Then he was standing at the foot of another set of earthen steps, his light shining skyward into another steel door. He could go back, get the shovel, take an awkward whack at it. Instead, he pulled his pistol, drew a bead on the rusted padlock, took a breath, fired. An hour later, Ethan closed the tailgate and the back hatch. He returned the rifle to the gun rack. He draped himself across the hood, salt water burning his eyes. The light down here in the gloom of the forest was nearly gone. It was so quiet, he could hear his heart pounding against the metal. When he could breathe normally again, he stood. He'd been hot, but now the sweat felt clammy and chilled his skin. "What the hell are you into?" Ethan spun. Pam stood peering through the tinted glass into the back of the Bronco, as if she'd materialized out of nothing. Wore tight-fitting blue jeans that showed her figure and a red tank top, her hair pulled back into a ponytail. Ethan studied her trim waistline. She wasn't armed as far as he could see unless she was packing something compact in the small of her back.
"You checking me out, Sheriff?"
"Do you have a weapon?"
"Oh, right. That's the only reason you're ogling me."
Pam lifted her arms over her head like a ballerina, went up on point in her tennis shoes, did a little twirl. She didn't have a weapon.
"See," she said. "Nothing in these jeans but little old me."
Ethan pulled the pistol out of his holster, held it at his side. Alas, empty.
"That's a big gun, Sheriff. You know what they say about guys with big guns?"
"It's a Desert Eagle."
"50 caliber?
"That's right."
"You could kill a grizzly bear with that beast."
"I know what you did to Alyssa," Ethan said. "I know it was you and Pilcher."
"Why?"
Pam ventured a step toward him, 8 feet away. She said,
"Interesting."
"What?"
"I've now closed the distance between us. 2 steps, 2 big steps, and I could be all up in your personal space, and yet you haven't even threatened me."
"Maybe I want you in my personal space."
"I made myself available to you, and you would rather fuck your wife. What's bothering me, the rub, if you will, is that you're a pragmatist."
"I'm not following." But he was.
"A man of few words and less bullshit. One of the things about you that make me want you. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that if there were any bullets in that gun, you'd have drawn down on me at first sight and wasted my ass. I mean, that's really your only move at this point, right? Am I on to something?"
She took another step toward him. Ethan said, "There's something else you haven't considered."
"Oh?"
"Maybe I want you in my personal space for another reason."
"And what might that be?"
Another step. He could smell her now, the shampoo she used this morning, her minty breath.
"Shooting is so impersonal," Ethan said. "Maybe instead of that, I want to pin you down and beat you to death with my bare hands."
Pam smiled.
"You had that chance before."
"I remember. You got the jump on me. Wasn't a fair fight."
"For who?"
"I was drugged, for fuck's sake."
Ethan raised the pistol and pointed it at her face. She said, "That's a big hole at the end of that gun." Ethan thumbed back the hammer. For a beat, hesitation in her eyes. She blinked. Ethan said, "Think long and hard. Out of all the moments you've experienced, is this the one you want to be your last? Because it's heading fast in that direction." She was wavering, not exactly fear in her eyes, but uncertainty, disdain for a situation she was not controlling. Then it passed, that steel resolve returning. A smirk curled her lips. She had balls. No way around that fact. She was about to call his bluff. When her mouth opened, he squeezed the trigger. The hammer snapped down into the firing pin. Pam flinched. A split second of, "Am I dead?" self-doubt. Ethan spun the pistol in his hand, gripped it by the barrel, and swung with everything he had, 4.5 pounds of Israeli-made steel on a collision course with her skull, and it would have smashed it in, but Pam weaved at the last conceivable second. As the momentum of Ethan's swing turned him sideways, she hooked him in the kidney with a blow of such stunning and direct force, it brought Ethan to his knees, a bright release of incendiary pain flashing through his lower back, and before he could even fully appreciate that pain, she punched him in the throat. He was on the ground, face against the forest floor, world askew, and wondering if she'd crushed his trachea because he couldn't draw breath. Pam squatted down in front of him.
"Don't tell me it was that easy," she said. "I had this all built up in my mind, you know? But two shots and you're asphyxiating on the ground like a little bitch?"
He was fading, his vision igniting with oxygen-deprived pyrotechnics. There. Finally. Right on the cusp of uncontrolled panic, something gave. A trickle of precious air slid down his throat. He tried not to let on, made his eyes bug out as he inched his hand into his back pocket, the harpy.
"As you lay there, suffocating, I want you to know something."
Ethan worked his thumb into the hole in the blade.
"Whatever you were trying to pull off, you failed. And Teresa and Ben..."
He produced a wet, choking sound that made Pam smile.
"What I do to them will make what we did to Alyssa seem like a day at the spa."
He flicked the blade open and shoved it straight into Pam's leg. It was so sharp he only knew he'd aimed well when she gasped. He turned his wrist, turned the blade. Pam shrieked and jerked back away from him. Blood darkened her jeans, ran down over her shoe into the pine needles. Ethan struggled to sit up, came painfully to his feet. His kidney was throbbing, but at least he could breathe again. Pam was dragging herself away from him with her good leg, seething.
"You're dead! You're fucking dead!"
He picked up the Desert Eagle and followed her. As she screamed at him, he bent over and brought the heavy pistol down on the back of her head. The forest was quiet again, the evening gone deep blue. He was fucked. Absolutely fucked. How long could Pam be AWOL before Pilcher sent out a search party? Strike that, there wouldn't even be a search. He'd just dial in on her chip and come right to the fence. Unless... With the harpy, Ethan cut out a large swath of Pam's jeans, exposing the back of her leg. A shame she couldn't be conscious for this. Chapter 21. Superstructure.
Wayward Pines, Idaho, New Year's Eve 2013. Pilcher closed the doors to his office behind him, giddy, practically vibrating with energy. Moving past the architect's miniature of the future Wayward Pines, he opened the closet, where a pristine tux hung from the rack.
"David?"
He turned, smiled.
"Sweetheart, I didn't see you there."
His wife sat on one of the couches that faced the wall of screens. He started unbuttoning his shirt as he walked toward her, said, "I thought you'd be dressed by now."
"Come sit with me, Dave."
Pilcher took a seat beside her on the plush leather. She put her hand on his knee.
"Big night," she said. "Does it get any bigger?"
"I'm really happy for you. You did it."
"We did it. Without you, I..."
"Just listen."
"What's wrong?"
Her eyes welled up.
"I've decided to stay behind."
"Stay?"
"I want to see the end of my story in the present, in this world."
"What are you talking about?"
"Please don't raise your voice with me."
"I'm not, I just..." "Tonight, of all nights, you choose to tell me this? How long have you felt this way?"
"A while. I didn't want to disappoint you. There were so many times I almost said something.
Are you scared? Is that it? Look, that's totally normal.
It's not that."
Pilcher leaned back into the cushion and stared at the blank screens. He said,
"Our entire life together has been building toward tonight. It's all been about tonight, and you're walking away from it?"
"I'm sorry."
"This means you're walking away from your daughter."
"No, it doesn't."
He stared at her.
"How does it not? Explain that to me."
"Alyssa is 10 years old. Middle school is right around the corner. I don't want her first dance to be in this town that's not even built 2,000 years from now. Her first kiss? University? Seeing the world? What happens to those moments?"
"She can still have them. Well, some of them."
"She's already sacrificed so much since we've moved into the superstructure. Her life, my life, is here and now, and you don't know what the future holds. You don't know what this world will be like when you come out of suspension."
"Elizabeth, you've known me for 25 years. Have I ever done or said anything that would lead you to believe I would allow you to take my daughter away from me?"
"David,
please just answer that."
"It's not fair to her."
"Not fair? She's getting an opportunity no human being has ever been given, to see the future."
"I want her to have a normal life, David."
"Where is she?"
"What?
Right now, where is my daughter?"
"In her room, packing. We'll stay through the party."
"Please." The desperation in his voice surprised him. "How do you expect me to be separated from my daughter?"
"Oh, fuck off!"
A flash of pent-up fury.
"She barely knows you as it is."
"Elizabeth, I barely know you as it is.
Let's not pretend all this hasn't been your obsession, your first love. Not me, not Alyssa."
"That's not true."
"This project has consumed you. The last 5 years, I've watched you change into something deeply unpleasant. You've crossed more than a few lines, and I wonder if you fully even know what you've become."
"I've done what I had to do to reach tonight. I make no apologies. I said from the beginning there was nothing that was going to stop me."
"Well, I hope it's all worth it in the end."
"Please don't do this. This should be the greatest night of my life. Our lives. I want you there on the other side when we all wake up."
"I can't do it. I'm sorry."
Pilcher took a long breath in, let it slowly out.
"This must have been difficult for you," he said.
"You have no idea."
You'll at least stay on through the party?
Of course.
He leaned over and kissed her on the cheek. Couldn't remember the last time he'd done that.
I should talk to Alyssa, he said.
After the party, we'll say our goodbyes.
She stood, gray Chanel dress, wavy silver hair. He watched her move gracefully toward the oak doors. When she was gone, Pilcher went to his desk, lifted the phone, dialed. Arnold Pope answered on the first ring. It would have been the best champagne Hassler had ever tasted, if he could appreciate it, but the nerves were getting to him. This place was unreal. Word was, it had taken 32 years to complete the tunneling, the blasting, the excavation. The price tag must have been north of $50 billion. An entire fleet of 747s could have fit inside that cavernous warehouse, but he had a hunch the real money had gone into the room where he stood now. It was the size of a grocery store. Hundreds of drink machine-sized units stood hissing and beeping as far back as he could see. Some of them vented white gas, the vapor hovering 10 feet above the floor. It was like walking through a cold blue fog. The ceiling invisible, the cold air pure and ionized.
Would you like to see her, Adam?
The voice startled him. Hassler turned, faced Pilcher. The man looked dapper in a crisp tuxedo, champagne flute in one hand.
Yes, Hassler said. Right this way.
Pilcher led him down a long row toward the back of the room, and then up another aisle of machines.
Here we are, he said.
There was a keypad, gauges, readouts, and a digital nameplate. Teresa Leidenberg. Suspension date, 12/19/13. Seattle, Washington. Down the front of the machine streaked a thick pane of glass, 2 inches wide. Through it, he saw black sand and a patch of skin, Teresa's cheek. Hassler involuntarily touched the glass.
We're about to get started, Pilcher said. Is she dreaming?
Hassler asked.
None of our testing, and there's been plenty of it, indicates any level of sentience during suspension. There's no brainwave activity. The longest we've put any of our test subjects under has been for 19 months. No one reported any sense of time while they were down. So it's like a light switch going off? Something like that. Did you get a chance to read the memorandum in your room? Everybody got one.
No. I just finished the medical exam and came straight here.
Ah, well, you'll be in for a few surprises.
Is everyone on our team going under tonight?
A small group has been chosen to stay behind for the next 20 years. They'll continue to gather provisions, make sure we have the latest technology, tie up a few loose ends.
But you're going under.
Of course, Pilcher laughed. I'm not getting any younger. I'd rather bank my time in the world to come. We should get back out there.
Hassler followed him out into the cavern. Pilcher's people were waiting, everyone dressed to the nines, men in tuxes, women in little black dresses. Pilcher climbed up onto a crate and looked out over the crowd. He smiled. In the light of a giant globe that hung down from a cable in the rock above, Hassler thought he saw Pilcher's eyes turn glassy with emotion. He said,
"Tonight we come to the end of a journey 32 years in the making. But like all endings, it's also a beginning. As we say goodbye to the world we know, we look forward to the world to come, the world that waits for us 2,000 years from now. I'm excited. I know you are too. And maybe you're also afraid, but that's okay. Fear means you're alive, pushing boundaries. No adventure without fear. And my God, are we all on the brink of one hell of an adventure."
He raised his glass.
"I would like to propose a toast to each and every one of you who've come this far with me and are about to take this final leap of faith. I promise you, the parachutes will open. Nervous laugh.